As an outside consultant, it was really helpful to be outside of the power structure of the institution. I could go into the C-suite without feeling a lot of pressure besides my own social awkwardness.
Welcome back to Insights by Design, where we take your data to Eureka. We use proprietary frameworks, systems, and technology to drive business value. Today, we'll talk about the technology that surrounds UX design, product management, and data analytics. CES just happened, and there's a lot of exciting things on the horizon. AI is playing a major role. But there's a lot of technology and principles that also haven't changed that much, which are going to continue to be core systems and concepts for both UX and data analytics. Michael, how are you doing today?
I am freezing cold, Andrew. How are you?
I'm good. Yeah, here in Phoenix, where we both live, being 60 degrees is freezing for us.
We really shouldn't complain because a lot of people out there are buried under 3 feet of snow and record cold temperatures. But man, after living in Phoenix and Charleston, South Carolina, I really can't handle anything under 60 degrees. My body just can't take it anymore. It's funny how quickly you adjust.
100%. Go back and visit Colorado. 19 degrees doesn't feel that cold because of the context that you're in. But when you come here and it's 55, 60 degrees, it feels super cold.
Yeah, we had to survive the 120 degree summers. And so 60 degrees is a 60 degree difference.
That's true. That's a good way to look at it. Well, let's kick it off with UX. Michael, let's talk about the technology surrounding UX. What's out there? What works? What some of the core principles are and the trends that we're seeing in 2024?
Every company and every researcher, every designer will have their own preferences, of course. You could go into a company and they say, we use user Zoom technologies, or we use Toby technologies, and that's just the way it is. But like you said, Andrew, a lot of the principles surrounding UX don't really change because they're robust and they work really well. The field will continue to evolve, of course, but there's going to be a few constants, I think. When people dive into a new project, they often think, okay, like I want to get like these super high-end technologies to get this super rich data. And that could be appropriate for the project. But when I work with new UX people, I often encourage them to start with the senses, their eyeballs, their voice, and their ears, because you can learn an awful lot just by watching people, just by listening to people, just by being present. And actually, sometimes those high-end technologies can work against your purposes, because if a project is very early stage, for example, and you're just trying to validate a concept and figure out whether it's even a good idea to pursue it and develop it into a digital product, people are going to be more hesitant to be candid with you, I would say, if you show them a bunch of razzle-dazzle, if you show them a bunch of technologies. But if you just scribble out your ideas on a piece of paper, for example, then your users can see, okay, I can see that this is an early stage concept, and they feel more comfortable saying negative things about it as well as positive things. And so there's an awful lot that you can do just with your basic senses and just with a pencil and a piece of paper. This last year, I was at a conference on UX, and this one presenter honestly blew my mind about the power of paper prototypes. Rather than building something right away in Figma or Adobe XD, she taught her students, I believe they were computer science students, to build out how they thought the site should look in beta form, just using construction paper and post-it notes, and then have people interact with that paper prototype and see what they thought. And they were able to get some really good feedback. And this is not just being lazy. This also saves a lot of time for your researchers and designers. If you can build something quickly and use your senses, then you don't have to fiddle around with some of the more extensive technologies that you might not be super familiar with yourself, and that can be a lot more time intensive. And so the starting point with any sort of UX project are just the basic technologies that the good Lord equipped you with, your eyeballs, your voice, your ears, or whatever senses you have available to you, acknowledging disabilities and learning differences and things like that. And then the number two technology is just pencil and paper. You can do an awful lot with just those basic things.
So it's the UX design of UX design. We found that a lot when I was in financial services and you were in managing investments and you really needed to convey concepts to clients, often very sophisticated clients in their own domain, but maybe not around financial services, which is why they hired you. And when you showed them big, fancy presentations, sometimes it worked, but often my best conversations and biggest sales were really just working out concepts on either a whiteboard or a pencil and paper with a client and trying to convey that information through simple diagrams. And I feel like it came across as more genuine and natural, built credibility and trust.
It also forces you to know your stuff, because if you can sketch out your idea in real time, then users will have more confidence, or your stakeholders will have more confidence that you actually know what you're talking about, as opposed to just showing a complicated screen and letting the screen do the thinking for you.
I try to do that when I teach live. I link up a Remarkable tablet to my Zoom, so that I can share when I draw on my tablet, it's drawing real time on the screen. It not only is helpful for me, but I think helpful for the students. You're seeing that a lot in the internet space as well with live streaming. On Twitch, there's a fantastic channel, which I recommend following, called Pirate Software, where this individual worked for Blizzard and he creates video games and he'll often do it live on Twitch. But one of the things that he does is he just uses Paint, the old Paint program, to draw concepts just live on his stream. So he'll bring up the super low-tech Paint program and he'll just draw it out with his mouse real quick. And it comes across as genuine. It shows that he knows his stuff and he's able to prototype those ideas quickly with a very simple tool.
Wow. So I guess we could say that UX is partly performance art, and there's a lot of power in the face-to-face or the face-to-paper sort of performance. You don't need to have fancy technologies to convey a complex concept and to get really good data. But that said, there are a lot of technologies out there, and if you only use your eyeballs, your voice, your ear, your paper, your pencil, then you're not going to get a lot of good feedback on, say, a high fidelity prototype. So you do want to level up at some point, especially if your users aren't physically located in the same space as you. And one of the most basic technologies out there that we use in UX are screen recorders. Companies like ClickUp and FreeCam, ScreenRec, Loom, and they can often generate not just videos of what users are doing, they can often generate analytics as well and try to capture things like where do people click first, heat maps, preference testing, and stuff like that. And so they automate a lot of the more complex processes involved in UX research and try to spit out stuff that is much easier to interpret. And this is useful too, because a lot of times users they're not fully conscious of their preferences. They don't know why the things that they do. And so being able to actually observe them, either in a place where they're physically present or in a place where you're remote or not even watching, maybe you just review the recordings later, is really useful, because people tend to act differently when they know that they're guinea pigs. A lot of these screen recorders allow you to conduct testing and design research remotely, which can get you more authentic data in a lot of ways.
It sounds like one of your recommendations is to match the tool to the stage of the process that you're in. Being able to iterate quickly with more basic tools, sometimes just using your own senses at the very beginning to get some of those quick insights, pencil and paper, being able to create those prototypes and change them. It's much easier to erase a line on a piece of paper than to go back in and change a working prototype. I see that in data analytics as well. Being able to iterate quickly and then to have monitoring tools as you become more sophisticated to then make some of those more nuanced changes rather than hacking big features on and off of a project, being able to use the more sophisticated technology, which is going to pick up that nuance, is a later stage of the UX design process. Is that accurate?
Exactly. In fact, people have studied like what makes design thinking, this thing that we often praise in UX, what makes design thinking even unique? Because people have studied design, how designers work and act for years and years. There's decades of research on processes of design, but this thing that we're calling design thinking, what is the distinguishing feature? And as far as we can tell, the distinguishing feature is rapid prototyping. So it's not necessarily being artistic or wearing a black turtleneck with a beret or doing like any of those extraneous things. Really the key to design thinking, and I would say UX thinking more generally, is rapid prototyping. Don't keep the ideas in your head. Put them out there in the world and see how people respond. Make changes and then keep going back and embrace the process of failure, embrace the process of not knowing exactly what your users are going to say and do. And especially at those that early stage of the process, being able to change your prototypes quickly is so helpful. That way you don't sink a lot of time and resources into a high fidelity prototype only to find that it wasn't such a good idea in the first place. So like you said, matching the tool to the stage of the process is really critical. You can always level up later on and get more extensive and perhaps more persuasive or more rigorous data. But especially at the early stages, keep it simple. That's totally fine.
These are product management principles. There's the crossover between UX and product management and analytics, and having that product management mindset of continuous improvement, continuous design, and continuous integration is key for both UX and data analytics. And that's why at Insights by Design, drive these processes through a comprehensive product management experience and framework, because it takes into account these principles, but how you implement them is going to be specific to the project and the stage that you're in. Mm-hmm. But the technology is growing, and so the capabilities of new designers are going to be augmented. But I think that's going to create a new challenge in that new designers may be able to hide sloppy thinking, the core fundamentals and principles that drive successful design and analytics and user experiences don't change. But you need to have that strong foundation first before building with technology and tools. I wonder, in your opinion, do you think the cutting edge tools that are making it much easier for new UX designers and new product managers and new analysts to hide?
Time will tell. And I think you're right that these technologies can certainly be used well and not so well. And sometimes these fancy technologies can obscure bad thinking. But I'm not sure I have a good case study of that just yet, but maybe I can reassure our designers and our researcher principals out there that you don't have to be on the cutting edge. You can use technologies that are within your skill set. You can do an awful lot with technologies like Qualtrics, just survey data. Like those things don't change, and they can be a foundation for something that's maybe more intensive, such as eye trackers, and Tobii has been the industry leader in eye tracking for a long time. And we're seeing a lot of haptic technologies coming out, like Osso VR, Haply, the Shadow Robot Company, Tactical Haptics, just to name a few. But I think that danger is certainly there, Andrew, that we can be blinded by the technology and the newness or the seeming newness of some of these tools that are coming out, that we can lose our critical thinking and blind ourselves to the underlying thought processes, which are what really matters. Like, it's not just the end screen that is really important in UX design. It's the ethics behind it. It's the thought process. It's the branding. It's advocating for users. And so we need to be careful not to lose those core principles amid the rush to adopt the latest technologies.
And I've heard concerns from folks who are trying to become data analysts. They're like, am I going to be replaced by technology? ChatGPT, Llama, they can write Python, they can write SQL. am I going to be replaced? Is it even worth becoming a data analyst at this point? And in my opinion, if you're a gopher, if you are only getting data, but you're not using that critical thinking and interacting with the business and driving value, you're probably going to be replaced by a computer. Mm-hmm. As director of data analytics at ASU, I don't really care how I get the data. I don't care who wrote it. I don't care who did the project. I'm going to QA it and I'm going to go in depth. I'm going to make sure that it meets the business needs. I'm going to use my critical thinking around what data was retrieved to make sure the quality is right and the governance was followed and that it drives the right business decisions. If that's a person or if that's a computer, it doesn't really matter to me. I'm still going to use my critical thinking in that space to make that business impact. But if there's a data analyst who's not making business impact and they're really just being reactive to getting a data request, they're pulling the data and sending it out. There was no design thinking around it. There was no trying to understand the jobs to be done or the business value that's trying to be driven. A computer could do your job then. But if you're taking that extra step of the product management and user understanding and driving that UX experience, that's not going to replace you. You still need a human in the loop. And then technology is going to augment you to make you better rather than replace you.
Mm-hmm. And I think up in the C-suite, it could be really tempting to just look at the bottom line. Like the computer says this, or the analyst says this, and ignore the process of getting that final result. Recently, I saw a really interesting presentation about topic modeling. And this person was trying to show us how to teach students this kind of this pretty, a complex process of coding. And she made it really simple, just like click these four buttons with this huge data set from Twitter, and we get this final result. We can see like the four main topics in these like 115,000 tweets or something like that. But what she also showed us were all of the lines of code where a lot of really subjective decisions were made, ranging from which R package to use, which snippets of Python code, how many topics to include, and how to plot them on that intertopic distance map. And those of you who have done topic modeling probably know what I'm talking about. It's basically an x-axis and a y-axis, and it shows you areas of overlap. And I think data analytics professionals are really valuable for being the leaders in making good parameters for things like that, because no matter how fancy the technology is, it tends to become a black box, this inscrutable thing that outputs data that people don't really understand. People being like C-suite executives or maybe a lot of UX people who are non-specialized, I guess we could say. But there's a lot of decisions within that black box that determine what the output is. And so one way that data analysts, I think, can really argue for their value is that they unpack the black box. So no matter what tools people are bringing to a project, we're going to need people to understand the back end so that we can tell the history of the data, the quality of the data, and what decisions we can make based on the data. The black box really matters.
And that's a trend that we're seeing in the data analytics side of our process, the knowledge barriers to upskilling a data analyst into machine learning and predictions and neural networks. Previously, they'd really have to learn Python. They'd need to go deep on it. They need to understand the underlying assumptions and the trade-offs around those techniques. But now there are companies who are making a clean UI and just have the data run on the back end. But you need somebody who still understands the trade-offs and what's being run and which model's being run and why and how it is different from this other model, which probably could be used, and what's the trade-off or assumptions around that. And as you noted, hyperparameter tuning, where you really need to make some decisions around those parameters, there needs to be some kind of rationale and understanding. There needs to be a human in the loop. But if you're just upskilling a data analyst and saying, here's the UI, now you can run machine learning if you click these two buttons, that's not going to do it. You need to have somebody who still, understands the back end so that there's transparency and there's effectiveness for those upskilling processes. two examples to corresponding companies which are doing the same thing. I'm working with both two startups, which are both in this upskilling data analysts into machine learning through low code solutions space. One, beautiful software, very robust, but the back end is all written in C, C+, which I don't understand. And when I asked them around, we ran a predictive model and then we created a neural network. I asked them if I could see the code for the back end so that I could understand what are the assumptions, what are the limitations, what were some of the decisions that were made. And they're like, do you read C? No, they're like, that process we just ran is probably 10,000 lines of code. Conversely, this other company that I'm working with, very similar concept of upskilling data analysts into machine learning, neural networks, artificial intelligence. But their back end is written in the less efficient but more transparent Python. And you can see the back end code. It's much easier to understand. And their documentation is very robust around if you're running neural network, it's running a trade-off between these models and it selects them based on these criteria. And there's trade-offs and limitations, right? But they're upfront and transparent around it. So even though the software running Python on the back end is less efficient, it's much more transparent and I'm much more excited or apt to recommend this software running Python with the great documentation than the software, which, to be frank, is very robust, but for me, hard to check without me going out and just building the model myself in Python and seeing what the output is and compare it to what this low code or no code solution is. So your point to understanding the back end and the assumptions and being responsible for the output of the models is critical for data analysts and for businesses.
So we've been focusing on data analysts, but I would say that if you're a UX professional, you're not off the hook either, because there's so many vendors out there who will say, try this technology, try this tool, try this, try that. But if you don't understand at least a little bit of the back end, it's hard to tell what the trade-offs are. What is the tool allowing you to see or not see? And this is really important in things like unmoderated usability testing. So Jakob Nielsen has a famous paper that basically showed, if I'm understanding it correctly, that you really only need to have about 5 users in at least an in-person moderated usability test to identify most of the problems in your digital product. He says that people have been misunderstanding that paper. Maybe I have too. I need to go back and read it. He posted about this recently on LinkedIn. But for some companies, especially those that serve, say, thousands or even millions of people on their landing page, I'm thinking of Airbnb in particular, who does not just A and B testing, but A, B, C, D, E, F, G testing to try to optimize their landing page, 5 users probably isn't going to cut it. And so things like remote unmoderated usability testing can give you a lot more data, but it's going to exceed your human capacity. You're going to need to trust users to run the protocol on their own and trust the tool to deliver the data to you in ways that you can make effective business decisions and drive business value. And if you don't understand things like how is the protocol for the usability test going to be delivered to users, at what point is their camera going to turn on? Is it going to track their screen? Is it going to teach them to do a think aloud protocol so that you can capture some sense of their cognition in real time? It's going to be a lot harder to make sense of those data analytics and whether you're even using the right tool. Every tool, like there's not a single remote unmoderated usability test technology that is exactly the same. And if you're going to recommend a vendor to your bosses, for example, you better know the pros and cons and have a sense of what the trade-offs are going to be, because it's not a one-size-fits-all solution for most companies. Different vendors are going to serve your company better than others.
That a lot. And being able to make those critical decisions is generally what separates great leaders from okay leaders or non-leaders. I hear this a lot in the data analytics space of trying to choose, for instance, a visualization. I'll consult with companies and they'll ask me a basic question, such as, should I use Tableau or Power BI? And it depends. depends what their use case is, where they see themselves going, what they need their scale to be. Do they live in the Microsoft ecosystem and is that important to them? Are they going to use the visualization tool for more data analysis or more for reporting? So it really just depends. Do they want a robust community? Do they not? Do they want specific certification skills? Do they not? Do they want both? I've worked at a lot of companies which frankly use both of them because Tableau is much better at data analytics and exploration, where Power BI is much better at reporting and monitoring and living in the Microsoft ecosystem. So it really just depends, but it takes sometimes that experience and that ability to manage trade-offs through a thoughtful framework and decision-making process to use technology appropriately to get business value.
Mm-hmm. And what would you say to Luddites, people who just have, let's say they've learned Tableau and they don't want to upskill? What are the hazards of something like that?
You need to understand core principles always and first. Regardless of what technology or use case is out there, you have to understand the core principles of design, of user needs, of data analytics, of visual communication, because those are transferable to any scenario and any technology. You can fully address business needs in Excel if you have the same core principles and understanding. You can do it easier and faster in Tableau using those same core understanding and principles of design and business value. So you should be, what's it called when you're agnostic? You should be tool agnostic and focus on deep principles. It's too easy to approach a career or a project with a tool first mentality and say, okay, I just need to learn Tableau real fast. I need to learn how to make pretty charts and change the colors and the tool tips, and that'll get me a job. And it probably will, but are they the right tools and the right tool tips for the right audience at the right time, driving the right value for the right need? That's a deeper question. And you could address that in Power BI, Excel, Looker, Click. It doesn't matter. Paper and pencil. It doesn't matter the tool if you ground yourself in core principles.
So it's important to tailor the tool to the task.
Yes, it's important to tailor the tool to the task, but it's more important to understand the core concepts first and then use whatever tools available to you. Most companies aren't asking you, what tool do you want to use? They're like, hey, you're a data analyst. We use Power BI. We switch companies. Hey, you're a data analyst. We use Click. Switch companies again. Hey, you're a data analyst. We use Tableau. If you understand those core concepts, it doesn't matter what tool you're using. You're going to deliver value regardless because the principles don't change. It just depends what buttons you're clicking.
I think in UX, it is important to acknowledge that sometimes, like you mentioned, and like I think I mentioned earlier in the podcast, sometimes your company just says, here are the tools that we use, go make them work. The tool is your constraint. But sometimes the tool can constrain the sorts of questions you can even ask of your data. And so you can be really hooked on Tableau, or you could be really hooked on User Zoom or something like that. Or maybe you're really good at designing Qualtrics surveys, but you'll find with your survey data that you get really a broad spread of insights, but you don't get really deeper insights into what people think and feel. So you better learn how to do focus groups or interviews or contextual inquiry that takes your data to the next level. And when I teach UX here at ASU, I talk a lot about data and tool triangulation. Look at your data through multiple angles if you have the time, because every technological tool, no matter how basic or how fancy, is going to have trade-offs like we've been talking about. It allows you to see certain things, but it's also important to acknowledge what it doesn't allow you to see, or at least what it doesn't allow you to see very clearly. And so I think being aware of your vision with these particular tools is one of the core concepts that UX professionals need to learn, but data analysts as well. That's an area of significant overlap. What is the tool allowing you to see and not see?
And that's a core competency of what we're doing at Insights by Design, is being able to identify some of those limitations and the strengths and make the best of either what stack is already in existence to drive the business value and the right insights for the stakeholders, or to make a recommendation based on business needs as to which stack may be most appropriate and the best value for them to really get those business results. Regardless of if it's product management, data visualization, UX, each tool has trade-offs. Each business scenario has different needs, and you just line those up where the trade-offs make the most sense for you.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes you're so immersed in your data, you're so immersed in your projects that even with the fanciest technological tools or the most basic technological tools, you can't see certain things. And that's why consultants can be so useful. There's a lot of power sometimes in being an outsider. And I was thinking just recently of this writer by the name of Tom Wolfe. And he was famous for wearing a white suit on a lot of his investigative projects. And people would say, like, you look ridiculous. You stand out like a sore thumb. Why do you wear a white suit when you go out and you talk to people? And his response was, you know, to paraphrase, exactly. Like, this white suit has done me so much good. I don't try to fit in. I try to stand out because people don't know I'm a member of this biker gang or this company or whatever. I'm allowed to ask really obvious questions that sometimes insiders can't without looking really foolish. And so, in addition to having a good suite of technological tools, I think that companies can add a lot of business value by hiring strategically outsiders to come and give them basically a white suit look at some of their processes and procedures. Because sometimes you need people to come in and ask seemingly obvious questions, or to look at your company or your digital products with new eyes and see them in ways that you haven't before.
100%. Yeah, that was part of our process, identifying key stakeholders and providing data requests to validate assumptions and get more information. Often we'll find that some of the assumptions from the executive sponsors aren't correct or aren't exactly what they thought because they're not in the day-to-day processes. So we're able to uncover either inefficiencies or inaccuracies and be able to hone those to make sure that the insight process is aligned with their needs, it's optimized, and the role of technology is very clear in what's technology doing and what are the practitioners doing and whose role is what. Who's making the decisions? So incredibly helpful.
I find too that every company has friction points in their communication processes or in their data flow process. At a lot of places, the CEOs are not hanging out with the frontline workers and vice versa. And I was thinking of this project that we did at an emergency department back in South Carolina. We were trying to update the signage, and signage is a really crazy part of the emergency department experience. Really simple technology, but nobody really knew who owned the signage, who had the power to say, yes, you can do that, or no, you can't do that. And so we had to talk to the frontline nurses all the way up to the managers in the C-suite, because they all had opinions that mattered. They weren't always talking to each other. And as outside consultants, I was working with an insider, but as an outside consultant, it was really helpful to be outside of the power structure of the institution. I could go into the C-suite without feeling a lot of pressure besides my own social awkwardness. But I could also just hang out in the waiting room and observe how people interact with the signage and where they got lost and feel, besides my social awkwardness, I'm pretty much right at home. And so that's one of the advantages that I think consultants bring to a business. They're outside of your power structure, apart from, you know, their contractual obligations. And they can often move in between the cracks and identify the friction points that you need to accomplish a particular project at a particular time.
100% agree. In your opinion, what's the role of technology in UX design versus the role of the practitioner?
The role of technology in UX design. It depends what you mean by UX design, of course. UX is very dependent on prototyping technologies like Figma and Adobe XD. And so it's hard to do UX design nowadays, at least with digital products, without other digital products that produce the stuff. And it's hard to be a UX designer without some understanding of Figma or Adobe XD especially, but Sketch and Envision and Acture are also different options. Or PowerPoint makes really good digital products as well, depending on your project as well. And so you need to understand the creative technologies, what they allow you to do, what they don't allow you to do, or pencil and paper. But then, like we've been talking about, there's a whole suite of assessment technologies, and that's where things start to get really complicated. And that's where having a good relationship with outside vendors can be really useful. There are some companies that offer a variety of different technologies, ranging from unmoderated usability testing to focus groups. Some companies will set up consumer panels for you so that you don't have to do the recruiting. And so technology is infused all throughout UX design, both the creative side and the assessment side. And like we've been saying, understanding which to use when tends to be a product of both company culture and your own individual judgment.
And as a follow-up question, what impact do you think AI, specifically generative AI, which is more interactive and more prescriptive in its outputs, will impact the roles of technology and of practitioners?
Gosh, that's a huge question. From the UX side of things, and maybe we've talked about this before, but there's going to be a need for designers and researchers to design elegant, effective, ethical AI experiences and avoid the uncanny valley and making these technologies effective to use, a pleasure to use, and avoiding some of the biases perhaps that are endemic to our society, like racism and sexism and things like that. There's a whole lot of research out there showing that artificial intelligence technologies can be really biased towards particular groups of people, and that creates access issues. But in some ways, it can also automate parts of UX in particular that make it a lot more efficient. So I've been praising the virtues of paper and pencil and the basic senses, but there are some AI technologies out there, at least I've heard rumblings of them, I haven't used them myself, where you can say, hey, build me a Figma prototype with these parameters, build me a high fidelity website that looks like this. And so to some extent, if you know, if those rumors are true, then you can skip part of the low fidelity process and go straight to your high fidelity prototypes and get perhaps more robust feedback on a digital product that more closely resembles what you have for the end goal of users. But as with any technology, I think it's important for people to develop those core competencies of what is AI allowing you to see, generative AI specifically, and what is it allowing you not to see, and what are the core principles guiding your project so that you're controlling the tool and the tool is not controlling you.
And who, in your opinion, whose responsibility is it to ensure that user designs, experiences, analytics are ethical?
Everyone. Every single person in the company bears ethical responsibility to make sure they're not screwing up. Although, at least with my UX students, I really hammer on the point that they tend to be the user advocates in the design process, and they have to be able to mediate and advocate for users in lots of different contexts, ranging from the development meetings to the C-suite meetings where you're talking about budgets and strategies and things like that. So everyone in the company bears an ethical responsibility, but maybe because I'm a UXer myself, I'm gonna hammer on the UXers and say, we have more responsibility because of our positions in the companies that we work at.
And that's important, I think, with AI becoming more prevalent within tools and making supposed decisions, it's important to have that personal responsibility for ethics. Now there's often the AI governance will fall under data governance and set up some kind of parameters and rules, guidelines in order to use AI. And it's tempting to say, okay, I'm within the parameters, I'm within the letter of the law, it's ethical. But that avoids the, there's my kids. It avoids the personal responsibility of assessing whether the output or the design or whatnot is ethical, not just did it check the boxes that have been institutionally presented to me.
And that makes me wonder if there's also a personal risk in assuming ethical responsibility for the tools and technologies that are being used in a particular project. Maybe a UX designer or a data analyst chose to use a tool. Maybe it was simply handed it to them. But I don't know. You don't control every decision along the way when you're fulfilling a data request or when you're making a digital product. And I don't think you want to stand up as a UXer or a data analyst and be a convenient scapegoat for people to blame because they know that you're an ethical person. You take responsibility for decisions. And man, maybe we'll have to do a whole nother episode on blame mitigation or surviving in the corporate environment. Because when things go wrong, it's common for people to start pointing fingers and say, oh, this is your fault or this is your fault, which can be part of ethics as well. An ethical distribution of blame when things go wrong and who bears what level of accountability.
100%. And one trend that I'm seeing in terms of technology is that for the last several years, we've had what's called the modern data stack, where it's essentially, why can't I think? It's stacked lots of technologies on top of each other and try to create efficient data workflows and be able to be very scalable. It's also created a bit of a mess and a lot of inefficiencies and high cloud costs where there hadn't been before. What I'm seeing now is a return to institutionalization and an enterprise model of data governance. Before it was more federated, during the modern data stack era, which we're still in but coming out of, it was teams or departments building their own data stack, and data governance was more distributed. It was more of a data mesh before AI, generative AI came out last year. It's been out for a while, but was popularized last year. Data mesh was the big thing, which is creating shareable data products and sharing responsibility for data governance. I'm seeing a big pullback right now for enterprise data governance and enterprise controlled data quality. And I think that a driver of that is companies preparing to implement AI more extensively, because data quality, ethics, and control is going to be critical for a successful implementation of AI products. And a core part of that is going to be the procurement process and understanding the data privacy rules and how data is used within certain products. And then role-based access, understanding who can access these products and for what purpose, for data engineering, what data is allowed to flow up through these products and who's allowed to see and use it in an ethical way. Very hard to control that in a federated or distributed model. Much more easy, perhaps more inefficient, but much more easy to do that in a centralized enterprise data governance model.
I think where the rubber is really going to hit the road and with this is healthcare, because there's a lot of AI tools out there that can diagnose tumors maybe better than a lot of radiologists can, or that can comb through millions of words in medical records and come up with new diagnostic criteria. But these decisions have very real, very human consequences. And the AI, in a lot of ways, can see farther than any individual or any team of individuals can. And it also creates a lot of data that's potentially very sensitive and requires good data governance to be managed properly. So I'm going to do some research and try to learn more about how healthcare in particular is handling the challenge of these new AI tools. Like, if the radiologist doesn't see a tumor, but the AI tool does, what do you do? Or if your AI tools are accessing patient data, why and how and what are the restrictions and who has access to that? And then how do you even choose an ethical vendor for AI tools? And at what point of development do the tools have to be before they can be rolled out in a hospital? Or is the hospital using, I don't know, this is happening, but it's possible that hospitals are being used as beta testing for some of these technologies? What is the development process behind the technology before they're being sold to hospitals and clinics and other organizations to actually make decisions, and probably finance as well, because there's a lot of financial data out there that's really sensitive. And I'm less familiar with how AI is impacting financial services, but the issues you brought up, Andrew, I think are really key as tools move beyond just paper and pencil or even screen trackers or eye trackers or things like that, and starting to become tools that can make decisions that potentially have very high stakes.
It is a regulatory consideration, especially in these highly regulated industries that we've talked about. Financial services as a case study. So I help roll out tons of machine learning models at JP Morgan. Many of them were cutting edge and the first models that they had run in lots of different scenarios. And one of the considerations in legal and compliance was, if we roll out these AI models and they flag issues, we have to have a human in the loop in order to address the issue so that regulators can see JP Morgan found a supposed issue or a red flag. What was the process for addressing it and determining, one, was it actually a issue and red flag? Yes or no? If so, how was it addressed? And that has to be addressed by a human in the loop. So there was a risk of flagging too many things and then not being able to appropriately triage them, because a regulator will be all over that. Financial services companies are regulated at the federal and state level, especially if they're doing insurance. So it was definitely a consideration. Amazon in the retail space is quickly executing AI strategies. But they're doing it, in my opinion, very sloppily, which we have seen this week, in that if you look on the Amazon store, you can see lots of AI-generated ads, which are clearly awful. For instance, they'll have a chair with a price, but the title of the ad will be, ChatGPT cannot address this topic and cannot provide you this information. And that's the name of the item.
Well, hold on. So the AI is producing the advertising text, or is it creating images of products that don't actually exist?
It's creating the text, but the text is not being QA'd. And so it's coming out as things like, ChatGPT is a large language model and cannot do as directed. And that's the name of the chair that's for sale. It's a lot of products on Amazon. Amazon also recently just created a brand new rule for publishing Kindle books that you are now limited as an author to only publish 3 new Kindle books a day, because they're just being flooded by AI generated text and books. There's people that before they put this rule in were creating thousands of books a day and putting them on Kindle for sale.
Oh, that's so smart. I wish I would have thought of that.
I think being able to differentiate yourself as a clear human and driving, as we noted at the top of the episode, authenticity and that human interaction and connection is going to set excellent analysts and designers apart from those who are essentially just using and emulating AI and having that more cold technological experience without that human connection. I think that's going to be true for us as consultants driving insights through product management and design and research back design strategies, but also for content creators, for business executives. It's going to be more and more important to have that genuine human connection so that you are clearly not just an AI.
Yeah. I need to look into this, but I wonder what research is out there about how people respond to AI compared to an actual human, and how does their perceptions of a product or a tool change, whether it's ChatGPT on the other end of the chatbot, as opposed to Linda in Cleveland, who's actually answering your questions about a particular technology or service. And artificial intelligence is moving so quickly, I imagine that a lot of call centers are going to be even more automated as well. So you're going to hear the keys clicking and you're going to hear the robot voice, and it's going to have human-like qualities. But to what extent does that automation compromise the branding of your product and the connections that you're making with your users? I'm going to give myself some homework and learn more about that, and maybe we can return to it on a future episode. What has social science research found in how users interact with AI compared to actual humans? There was an article a little bit about how Alexa is not a feminist. And I forget the reasons why people were saying that Alexa was some feminist triumph, maybe because she was powerful or something like that, really knowledgeable. But as people start to analyze the voice data of how people actually interacted with Alexa, they found that a lot of people swore at Alexa. A lot of people said really dirty things to Alexa. And so sometimes these artificial technologies can bring out the worst in humanity rather than the best, because people assume there's no consequences and that there's no damage, there's no harm done in abusing a machine as opposed to abusing an actual living person.
I love that. I always say thank you to my Google and my ChatGPT because I want it to give me the best outputs.
They're working hard for you.
One, it's positive reinforcement when it gives me the right answer, because it goes back and labels that as a positive answer. So then it's going to make my data more, it's going to make the responses to my requests more accurate. Two, I'm worried about them taking over the world and I don't want them to kill me first. So I want them to remember that I said thank you. And three, I think it's important because as we get closer and closer to the test, the point in which a person is going to be unable to distinguish an interaction between a computer and an individual. It was in the 50s where they did a chat with a participant, and the participant didn't know if it was a computer or a person. The purpose was to see if the participant could tell the difference, if they could tell whether they were interacting with a computer through chat or whether they were interacting with a person through chat.
At some point, we should get a legal expert in here and talk about how artificial intelligence is impacting law. Because if artificial intelligence tools are getting so good that you could replicate the voice of the defendant on a phone call that never actually happened, or recreate videos showing them at a particular place and time when in fact they were at home eating Ben and Jerry's in bed and not committing a crime, then I think our legal system is going to be very complicated. And you and I often talk about finance and healthcare in particular, because that's what we know. But I'm really curious how data analytics and UX is going to be impacting the legal industry, which to some extent affects all of our lives. Because if I get in trouble someday, not that I ever will, it's not a plan or anything, this is not a prediction, but I don't want AI technologies messing up the evidence and preventing me from getting a fair trial. That's going to be a really messy issue.
And that's what President Biden has asked for, part of his AI, I don't know what you call it, presidential decree. He's bringing together the AI council. One of his asks was really to be able for the AI companies to figure out a way to kind of watermark AI content. There's a lot of debate. I believe that OpenAI was on board with that. They're like, yeah, we think that this should be something that we should work on, but how you do that, how you distinguish it from written material and video, and whether or not you can just edit that out remains to be seen. But in terms of law, AI, recently in Brazil, I believe just a couple weeks ago, a couple of the Brazilian government officials they presented legislation and they voted on it and it passed. And only after it passed did the presenting individuals reveal that it was completely written by ChatGPT.
Oh, man.
A law written by ChatGPT was presented by the councilman in Brazil. Everybody reviewed it, voted on it, and it
passed. As long as they reviewed it. But, oh, man. Machines literally writing legislation.
Literally wrote legislation. But then on the other hand, there's the famous case of, I think, two lawyers, maybe one lawyer, use ChatGPT to write his
legal brief or something.
It wasn't, a legal brief, and then all his citations were like fake. He got fired. But so there's both sides. So maybe the Brazilians actually kept a human in the loop instead of yep. just saying, hey, AI, here's my legal case. Write me a legal briefing on this and present it to the judge.
Oh, gosh. That seems to be a core concept that we keep coming back to, Andrew. Tools are great, but keep a human in the loop. That has to be a foundation of any ethical decision-making, no matter what company, whether you're a data analyst or a UX pro.
100%. And for those starting their careers, I think the advice that we're giving is be skilled enough and have a strong enough foundation to be the human in the loop. And then for businesses, it's to work on strategy and frameworks and bringing in consultants like us to help you determine where does that human reside in the loop and which humans are the right people to have in the loop. Great talk, Michael.